Page 94, the Private Eye Podcast.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Page 94. My name is Andrew Hunter Murray, and this episode we are going to be slightly more cheerful and festive because it has been observed in certain quarters that the last episode was about sewage and torture, and it just doesn't feel quite Christmassy enough to be tending in that direction again. So this time we have got two much more cheerful installments. We have a large family punch-up concerning the royal family. Every family should have one at Christmas. And we have also got a virtual edition of Private Eye live at the National. The Eye's big annual jamboree at the National Theatre has this year been Omicroned out of existence, but we have the wonderful Lewis McLeod and Jan Ravens, who are going to bring some bits of the Eye annual to life, and they're also going to be talking about their process in doing so as well. That's coming up later, but first, the big fun festive family punch-up concerning the royal family. There has been even more royal news in the papers and on TV than usual recently. That is partly due to a documentary which has just aired on the BBC called The Princes and the Press, presented by Amal Rajan, and it dealt with the ways that the royal family have dealt with the press in the past and the changing ways in which they're doing so right now. That's especially relevant because one of the other big bits of royal news recently is about a legal battle between the House of Sussex, the Duchess of Sussex, formerly known as Meghan Markle, and Associated Newspapers, who are the publishers of the Mail on Sunday. The Duchess has just won the latest stage in the legal battle. The whole heart of the matter was about a letter that Markle had written to her father, and which ended up in large part in the pages of the Mail on Sunday. Here to talk through the details of that latest legal struggle and through the way that it's ended up in the broadcast news as well, and the way that royal correspondents are also now under scrutiny, we have the Eye's crack Street of Shame team of Francis Ween and Adam McQueen. Here is Adam, first of all, talking about the letter itself.
The letter was originally written in 2018. It was published almost in its entirety in the Mail on Sunday early in 2019. And then long after Meghan had taken legal action, this book came out called Finding Freedom, which is this kind of saccharine, gushing biography of Harry and Meghan, written by Omid Scobie and Caroline Durant, which they maintained for ages and ages they had absolutely nothing to do with, and it was completely unofficial. But the Mail then tried to introduce aspects of the book, which is where we got to the point where it emerged that actually the Sussexes had forgotten, Meghan had just forgotten that she had actually briefed the authors quite heavily or authorised her then press secretary Jason Knauf to do so.
So the primary aspect is simply about whether the Mail on Sunday were within their rights to publish a large amount of this letter.
Yeah. The other aspect of that was that they then got a witness statement from Jason Knauf, the ex-member of the Sussexes staff now working for Prince William, who said not only that he'd been briefing people, but that there were emails from Meghan in which she talked about phrasing the letter in such a way that if it did leak, she would look better because of it. And they said that this was proof that the letter was being written for the public and therefore she didn't have a right of privacy within it. But that was something that was given fairly short shrift by the judges in the appeal court. And indeed, it was something they felt they didn't even have to consider as evidence, because the evidence from that was presented at the former trial was what was strong enough to kind of carry the verdict from that trial. So yeah, it's very complicated, but hopefully that makes it slightly clearer.
So the argument that was being put forward, that writing something with the knowledge that leaks happen then that it may be made public in due course, is not the same as writing it for publication, or you can't prove the intent to publish based on that. Is that basically what you're saying there?
That's essentially it, yeah.
Francis, can I bring you in at this point? Because I think you've been writing about how this story gets even more catnipish for the Daily Mail, involving not only the Sussexes, but also the BBC.
Yes, well, it was a perfect Mail on Sunday story, a perfect story for the Mail. And of course, now that the Mail on Sunday and the Daily Mail are united after their 100 years war, because the Mail on Sunday editor, Ted Verity, has been given the daily paper as well. So whereas in the old days, a Mail on Sunday splash would get rubbished in the daily paper, this one just ran and ran for weeks in the run-up to the broadcast and after the broadcast. And it was a classic sort of Mail-y Sunday splash, cobbled together out of nothing, something out of nothing. And they cooked it up with Kensington Palace. They said, oh, there's this royal documentary going out on the BBC, boo, and it's being presented by Amal Rajan, and we probably hate him as well, and we hate Meghan and Harry, and they seem to have some people speaking up for them in it, so it's just, we've got to trash it. And Kensington Palace were happy to go along with this. The original story, before the first episode went out, was a front page splash, and it said things like, the row over the programme has left the 95-year-old monarch upset. I mean, there was no row until they ran this story. So the idea that the Queen was sort of preemptively upset before she even knew about the thing is extraordinary. And they said it was a senior royal source condemned it as tittle-tattle. And the most idiotic thing that the palace did was to go along with the Mail and say, what they're most angry about is the BBC is still refusing to show the programme to courtiers before broadcast. A palace source said, there is upset about it. This is not fair. No one at the palace has seen it. And that was the real story here, which the Mail somehow missed, because this was a BBC Current Affairs documentary. It wasn't some sort of semi-official royal co-production like the Queen's Christmas message or something. It was a bit of journalism from the BBC produced by the Current Affairs Department. And the palace are now openly allowing it to be known that they demand the right to see, you know, episodes of Panorama or news bulletins or God knows what in advance. I mean, it's most extraordinary omission. And the Mail didn't think this was at all odd. They thought the real story was that the 95-year-old monarch was upset about some programme she'd never seen and didn't know anything about, really. But it was mainly because Harry and Meghan were being spoken up for and they thought it was biased. I mean, the only reason they had Harry and Meghan type spokespeople or supporters, like Meghan's lawyer and...
And Omid Scobie was the other
Omid
one, yeah.
Scobie, the unofficial Ho-Ho biographer, is that Kensington Palace, I mean, the production team and Amol Rajan, who presented it, the BBC people, had been in touch with all branches of the royal family throughout. They'd been in touch with Kensington Palace and with Buckingham Palace and all the rest of it, but particularly with Kensington, because there was this thing about the, not exact war, but, you know, the tension between William and Harry and how it's been covered. And it was much more about how newspapers had covered this and how they had done reverse ferrets from time to time, having been pro-Meghan and then anti-Meghan and anti-Wills as the idol prince and then saying he's the saviour of the nation. And so it was much more about how journalism works than anything to do with what was going on in the royal family. Anyway, they were offered, they were encouraged to cooperate with the documentary, but they didn't. I mean, they said, we'll keep us informed, but I don't think we're inclined to have anything to do with it. And no, we won't suggest any people you should interview who could be unofficial spokespeople for us. And then they complained after the event.
Isn't that part of the whole sort of never complain, never explain line of things that is the more old-fashioned way of doing your briefing, or to keep the briefing incredibly unofficial, rather than to have anyone actually speaking for you on camera?
Well, that essentially is what the BBC documentary was about, wasn't it? It was about moving on from that never complain, never explain thing to sending in letters from shillings about absolutely anything and anyone daring to breathe in the direction of Harry and Meghan. And, you know, legal stuff coming from William's side as well.
But it's also actually about the new version of never complain, never explain, because, of course, Prince William, who normally might seem to follow that rule, did famously complain over the Martin Bashir Panorama when that scandal erupted. It's hard to phrase this without identifying a source who very much doesn't want to be identified, but I have it on very good authority, shall we say, that the palace view after the programmes went out was that the documentaries were pretty good. But because of the Martin Bashir scandal, they have to put warning shots across the bows of the BBC from time to time. Nothing to do with the contents of the programme, but it's all still about Bashir, ultimately, just to remind the BBC that they're on probation and that they better tread carefully or else. So it didn't really matter what was in these particular Princes and the Press programmes. It was more Prince William doing, or people on his behalf, doing a little follow-up to his very angry statement about the Panorama and his mother.
The Mail, on the other hand, were absolutely furious after the programmes went out, not least because it didn't feature the tittle-tattle they'd been trailing and saying it was going to expose, which was mostly seemed to be about what William may or may not have said.
This needs a little bit of breaking down, so you're going to have to lead us slowly through this point, because it's a really interesting one.
So this goes back to that documentary, and that's just documentaries within documentaries in all of this, which again makes it incredibly complicated, as if the legal side wasn't bad enough. So there was the ITV documentary, which people will remember. It was Tom Bradbury following Harry and Meghan, who at that point were still part of, you know, the official royals, on their tour of Africa a couple of years ago. And it was the one where famously Meghan said that no one had asked her if she was okay, and Harry had talked about how appalling the press were and how awful their lives were generally. And it was briefed to the BBC's royal correspondent, Johnny Diamond, after that Prince William was concerned about his brother, who he thought was not in a good place. Now, that seems to be an entirely nice and sympathetic thing that you might be pleased that your brother was saying. But this has somehow somehow become a kind of war of words within between the two royal households about whether this was making disparaging comments about Harry's mental health, which, again, you know, the when they were together, both brothers have done work for mental health charities. They've talked openly about the effects on their mental health. William was talking about it even more recently in the podcast for Apple, which again was splashed all over, very sympathetically all over the Mail on Sunday a couple of weeks ago. So it's a rather extraordinary one to see where the harm was in that sort of comment. But that was being flagged up as this terrible war of words, which the BBC was awful for exploiting, and then turned out not to feature in the documentary at all as broadcast. So it turned out the only people who were really putting that into the story were William's people doing anonymous briefings about it, as far as I could tell.
Well, also, the Mail was slightly hoist by its own splash in having made such a fuss and started this whole fuss. Then episode one went out, and several people who saw it said to me at the time, is this the one they're getting in such a state about? I mean, it didn't seem to be that sensational. I mean, there wasn't anything there I hadn't sort of worked out for myself, though it was quite interesting to hear some of the comments, and this dodgy private detective seemed a bit interesting. Of course, that was the point. They hadn't known what was in it. They then had, hilariously, Janet Street Porter in the Mail did a column saying, "The first episode is hardly enough so far to merit all the fuss that preceded the screening." All the fuss made by the Mail. And then after episode two, as I think Adam said, they said in the Mail, "Amal Raj and show failed," in capital letters, "to feature claims William and Harry's households briefed against each other." They, as if they were jolly cross because it hadn't done what they said it was going to do.
This is such Byzantine stuff, and obviously the programme showed the processes by which the royal reporters all get their stories, you know, and the stronger or weaker sources they might have for them, and the sheer amount of briefing, because it seems to be an incredibly gossipy environment, and everyone is getting into it, not for the money or, you know, maybe even especially for the prestige, but simply so that they can brief against each other furiously.
Well, even people who were, I mean, you remember, well, you don't, you're far too young, back in the 90s when Richard Kay of the Daily Mail was caught getting into cars with Princess Diana and having discreet lunches with her. And when it came out that Andrew Morton's book had been as told to Andrew Morton by Princess Diana, that was the moment when it suddenly dawned on most people that these hacks weren't simply making it all up when they said, "I have very good sources." They really did have very good sources, and they had reason to run these stories. And Richard Kay has dined out ever since on having been, you know, Princess Diana's favourite hack and confidential mouthpiece. And then he, in his capacity now as the Mail's editor-at-large, was denouncing the BBC for suggesting, for including, what was it, Meghan's mouthpieces. Why did the BBC give airtime to Meghan's mouthpieces in its documentary? This from the man who's known to the world as Diana's mouthpiece. It is completely so full of humbug. It's not true. I mean, it's hilarious.
But the other side of that equation, in the War of the Waleses, as it was called in the 90s, was that Prince Charles had people who went out to speak on his behalf. And Nicholas Soames was never off the telly talking about how awful Diana was and how beleaguered and hard done by Charles was. And that, you know, had Prince William's household put up anyone to speak on their behalf, one of these turnip toffs that they like to hang around with over in East Anglia or anyone at all, then that, I'm sure, you know, Amal Rajan would have jumped on that and that would have been included in the documentary. They didn't take up that invitation and then got very, very cross, and the Mail got very, very cross about their side of the story supposedly not being represented. So it was all slightly bizarre around. I mean, the Sussexes went along with it and put up a spokeswoman from Shillings, who must have been being paid more than anyone has ever been paid to appear in any television documentary ever, if she was charging the usual amounts that Shillings charge for things. They put up her. And then did you see as well, he appeared really briefly in episode two, there was a friend of Harry's, and I think he billed as sort of a fellow father with kids the same age or something, and he got to say about three words and then disappeared off the screen immediately. So he was obviously the Nicholas Soames of the equation, but didn't come up with anything very good. So
and poor Amanda Patel complained, because she is a male columnist, and she, although the Mail was denouncing this programme, I was watching out to see if anyone from the Mail was in it, and there was old Mandy Platel. And so she, loyally following the Mail party line, after the event had to write yet another huge column saying, "I have been betrayed, I was conned into doing this, I had no idea, you know, they interviewed me for an hour or so and they only used about 5 minutes in the documentary."
Journalist shocks to find out about journalism.
For a television documentary before, that's par for the course. They come and spend all day at your house and then they give you 1 minute.
Her particular complaint was that they'd edited her to only be make it look like she was being nasty about Prince William and not Prince Harry. And anyone who's ever read Amanda Platelna column knows that her entire raison d'etre is she's utterly vile about absolutely everyone. I mean, that's what she does.
Well, tune in next year to find out how this thing goes on. And in fact, every year from now on forever. Nothing seems to have changed.
It is kind of one of those legal cases. It's a bit like when the Hamiltons sued Fayed, that you just sort of think, can everyone lose? Because everyone is all. I mean, the Mail on Sunday are just appalling. Meghan, you know, it turns out, is conveniently forgetting things and then remembering them just in time for the second hearing. And the dad is just, I mean, just everyone is just so horrible. Can't they all lose?
Adam McQueen there. Thanks to him and Francis Ween, and to read more on the Forever War as it carries on over the next decades. Why not save yourselves a lot of time and effort going around newsagents and get a subscription to the magazine right now? You can find those at private-i.co.uk. Now, we turn to the actual fiesta bit of the podcast. This is Private Eye, not live and not at the National Theatre. Jan Ravens and Lewis McLeod are two of the core team who have been bringing Private Eye from the page to the stage at the National Theatre each year. You may recognise their voices from shows like Dead Ringers or Spitting Image. So we thought it would be fun to get them in to perform for an audience of one, me, and now for an audience of thousands, you, and bring to life the key events, the highlights and the lowlights of yet another bloody year, 2021. The start of this year saw an enormous amount of wrangling over who had actually won the American presidential election. The wrangling was mostly between President Trump and everyone else. He was insisting that he had won. We all know where that led. The Capitol riots took place on the 6th of January. Here, though, in the pages of Private Eye, we were very lucky to secure an extract of President Trump talking about other enormous victories in American history.
The Battle of Little Bighorn. General Custard won a huge, huge victory. He won by lots. Lamestream Mindian media tried to fake the number of dead soldiers, but if they'd counted correctly, the U.S. cavalry won, and the loser Redskins were losers. Fact. Should have been orange. Pearl Harbor. Big win for U.S. Navy. Japanese bombs all missed by miles. Observers weren't allowed in to witness it, so the demo Japs claimed victory. Fake news. Court will prove that Pacific Fleet intact and demo Japs sunk. Vietnam War. I was there. Bayoneted several gooks with my bone spurs. U.S. suffered zero losses. Recount them. Paving way after smooth transition period to victory over democratic communism. Agent Orange wins by lots, i.e. me. I love the smell of bleach in the morning. 9/11. Failing loser demo terrorists completely missed the Trump Tower.
Warning. These claims of victory by President Trump have not been substantiated by the I moderator.
President Trump was not the only person who found himself looking for a new job. There were other positions posted, this time on this side of the pond. Priti Patel, the Home Secretary, found herself advertising in the early part of the year for a speechwriter to lead her Westminster team, reflecting the nuanced, careful voice of British statecraft that we know and love. Here's the advert she posted in Private Eye.
So, can you fucking write or not, you fucking wanker? I'm not going to ask again. Either you can capture my inimitable ball style or you fucking can't. I mean, are you useless or what? You are fired and I haven't even hired you yet. I will pay the going rate for this kind of work, namely £12,038,100.2700. Holidays? Are you fucking kidding? Unless you want to be fucking deported somewhere sunny. Right, all you have to do is get the fucking tone right, which can't be that hard. Now fuck off.
The Home Office is an equal opportunities employer and would like to remind the successful candidate that they will have to sign up to an HMG-approved course on bullying in the workplace and how to do it.
Obviously, the biggest story of this year continues to be COVID-19 as it continues rampaging its way around the world. There is so much to learn when it comes to dealing with a disease like this, not least the enormous amount of jargon that crops up into the public sphere and which everyone is suddenly expected to know. Earlier this year, the I published a guide to the key COVID terms that you may not have come across yet.
Pandemic.
Everyone gets COVID-19.
Pingdemic.
Everyone gets pinged on their phone and told to isolate, despite not being anywhere near a COVID sufferer.
Pingu-demic.
Parents of young children go mad after hearing the same theme tune every 5 minutes for days on end.
Pong-demic.
Everyone plays amazing new video game. Last happened in the 1970s.
Pangolin-demic.
The next disease we're all going to get from eating something we shouldn't, thanks to nobody having learned any lessons from the last time.
Pundemic.
Tidal waves of stupid and irritating jokes being made by people who are stuck at home due to bloody COVID rules.
That's more than enough of that, Ed.
The year saw a number of farewells. Most notably, perhaps, was, of course, Prince Philip, the Duke of Edinburgh, who died in April at the age of 99. This prompted an enormous outpouring of grief, and Private Eye's own Philippa Page had her heartfelt tribute published in the pages of the magazine.
I will never forget the moment I didn't meet the Duke of Edinburgh. It will be forever etched in my memory as a historic encounter which I can recount to my children and they can pass on to theirs. I was sitting at my desk when the editor came in and said, "I want 1,000 words on Prince Philip by lunchtime." I immediately thought back to the key moment when I never met him, and how he hadn't been rude to me at all, and how he hadn't put me at my ease, and how I hadn't been charmed by his no-nonsense, brusque but friendly manner. I said to the editor, "I never met him," and his reply spoke volumes. "Who cares? Make it 2,000 words. So I did, and I think it's fair to say that never meeting your Royal Highness, as I didn't call him, completely changed my life, and that after that day we didn't become close and I could never claim I was proud to call him my friend.
Continued page 94.
Foreign news now. The West's catastrophic withdrawal from Afghanistan as it fell to the Taliban in August prompted headlines around the world, and those repercussions are still being felt right now. This was a story of chaotic mismanagement. Nonetheless, there were some people who managed to ensure that their interests were being met in the case of the animals of Penfarthing Wood, which were all extracted from Kabul Airport. The Eye dug into their archives and found that this story was not without precedent.
Biblical times. Get my fucking animals out of here. Noah, in foul-mouthed rant. By our Middle Eastern staff, Harry Mount Zion. Prominent animal rescuer Noah, caught in the middle of an unfolding catastrophe last night, hit out at officials trying to prevent the evacuation of the last of Earth's animals from the disaster zone. Noah, who runs the charity Nohazat, swore at bureaucrats who were delaying the departure of his ark. Said a furious Noah, "If you don't help me, you will all fucking drown. You'll be finished. You will never work again or indeed breathe again, as waters will rise up and consume you." Noah's relief operation was heavily criticised by local politician Tom 2x2 Gendhat for not including any humans apart from his family and for leaving large numbers of civilians to their fate at the hands of religious extremist God. A spokesman for the Almighty said, "Give it a bit of time, say 40 days, and we think that everything will have quietened down due to everyone being dead, and that it will be then time for an olive branch to be offered." And
that's quite enough, Noah, for the moment. And finally, as the Conservative Party heading into winter shows signs of the sort of orgiastic chief killing which has so many times erupted throughout the party, Private Eye managed to find space for one of the people being talked up as a potential leadership contender. Liz Truss has been flying around the world in her post as Foreign Secretary, securing extraordinary trade deals for Britain. Here she is in the pages of The Eye discussing one of those deals.
"After weeks of intensive negotiations, I'm delighted to announce that I have secured a great deal for Britain. From now on, our supermarkets will be filled with the very best produce from Australia, including raw dingo meat and chlorinated crocodile and wallaby steaks. But those aren't all the zero tariff goodies we can look forward to from the land of the didgeridoo. Oh no, there's also prime kangaroo testicles, juicy wombat anus, and succulent platypus penis. Yes, it's one in the eye for the Remainer doom mongers who'd forgotten our great tradition of export deals with Australians. ever since we shipped them to the other side of the world for stealing the odd loaf of bread just because their families were starving, we've had close bonds of friendship. No wonder they've done us such a bonza deal.
So there you are, some selected highlights from the Private Eye Annual, which also comes in a glorious 100-page format between two lovely hardboard covers. That is still available now. You can still get yourself a glorious copy of that annual in time for Christmas. So do that now, or rather, do it very shortly, because Lewis and Jan are still with me now. We thought it would be fun to have a little chat about the process of bringing to life the extraordinary cast of gargoyles who make up public life today. First of all, I wanted to know, does it ever feel a little sad when a voice that you have, particularly a big voice, departs from the public scene? So, for example, we're currently having a brief spell off from Donald Trump. Lewis, is that a shame for you?
Yeah, I wasn't so bothered when he disappeared, because I think, you know, amazingly, to believe that it was just this year when it all kicked off in Washington, I was quite glad. I don't know how that'll... I don't think it'll ever be as comedic somehow. I don't know. If he does return to the stage.
Oh, do you think the comedy's slightly changed over the course of him being president, because things got so dark?
Yeah, they did. Yeah, absolutely. I think I was getting asked to do a lot of cameo videos, you know, where I would put the wig on and wish somebody a happy Christmas or a happy birthday. And I had to shut it down just because I couldn't be arsed. It's just like it was becoming too depressing, because it really was a horrible experience to watch that all going off in Washington.
Yeah. You know. Jan, do you have particular favourites? I mean, your Diane Abbott is obviously a thing of wonder.
Andrew. Well, of course, it was Theresa May who I lost. And but I wasn't sort of too unhappy about that either, because I was getting worried that she was just getting more and more tense, and that she was actually just going to kind of, you know, stay. No wonder she had coughing trouble, because it's a horrible voice to do for your own voice. You know, right. You want to say, Theresa, open your throat, love, you know, all that strain on the larynx, you know, it's not good for you. But I think so long as you've got some sort of big hitters like Diane Abbott and Liz Truss, where they're sort of high comedy, and then you can get your sort of nerdy impressionist kind of kicks from the sort of smaller, some more subtle characters.
Yeah, and Lewis, you must feel the same way about that, as in at the moment there are a few big hitters or big beasts or whatever.
Absolutely.
On the male side of the aisle.
On Ringers, it's great because we're allowed, there's such a kind of mix of styles. You know, you've got the sketch comedy, but there's lovely monologues, and I absolutely love it when I hear Jan doing a monologue, because it gives you a chance to really focus on what she's doing with the voice, and you really kind of get to sit back and just go, well, this is kind of magnificent. You know, there's not many people in the world that can do this, and I really enjoy that. And I enjoy the challenge of a new voice. I think on Ringers, we don't really share voices as much. Once we sit them down and we stay with them, but in other shows, you do, and so you kind of have to get used to that. But there's... I think everybody brings to mimicry, those that do it, a little bit of something that maybe that somebody hadn't noticed it before, or and I think that's always kind of cool that you can hear.
Lewis does lots of the kind of really kind of bravura characters. You know, there's sort of Boris Johnson, Jeremy Vine, Nigel Farage. I mean, I remember I used to love your George Galloway.
Thank you so much to you, Jan. A voice that, let us be frank, can talk for hours. We sit back on the horns of a dilemma. We three kings sitting here on this video map. But let us not forget the 3,000 who are falling to their deaths at the behest of Tony Blair.
And it's not, I suppose, when you're doing someone like Jeremy Vine, you're not doing it in quite the same way that you're doing Boris Johnson or George Galloway, where
there's more invective,
more ridicule.
Yeah.
And that must be interesting, because you are, I mean, both of you, and, you know, the whole Ringers team, you are, to an extent, shaping the way these people are seen and heard. And if you identify, as you said, some new element of their voice that... You know, that, like, the strangulation of Theresa May that you mentioned. You know, I wouldn't have consciously picked up on that unless you hear someone else doing it. And then...
Well, we had Nigel Farage as a motorcycle last week on Ringers. I don't know if that's going to stick around, but... He literally morphed into a motorbike.
Yeah, it's funny. I think newsreaders and presenters tend to kind of always love it. Like, you know, Fiona Bruce, you know, used to sort of say, I don't sound a bit like that. You know, I'm not a bit like that. And Kirsty Warwick, you know, Kirsty Warwick always great, you know, and sort of, you know, she sort of really likes all that kind of, you know, doing the song titles, you know, and the kind of, and so I think they like it because, you're sort of boosting their profile. I mean, I remember when I started doing BBC Radio 4, I'm Charlotte Green. And that year, Charlotte Green got, you know, most popular voice on Radio 4 or something. And I sort of felt that I was partly responsible.
Yes. As Boris has, obviously, in the last couple of years, he's had to drop a little bit of the jollity, considering a lot of the announcements he's had to make. So there's also a bit of a sad Boris now. Lewis, have you had to change?
Absolutely. That's bang on. Well pointed out, because of course when he got COVID and nearly died, I noticed a definite difference in his tone. It was a much more, his tone definitely lowered, and it was much more keeping it in that area.
Well, I hope that the next time you're both on the podcast, it's the Private Eye live at the National Theatre once again. And I hope that will be next year.
Yeah,
I was hoping it was going to be this year, but
might be all, yeah.
It might be one of those digital audience, which, you know, we've done with ringers, and they've got...
No, I hate that delayed digital audience.
Especially because they've got 1,000 people that some group of really clever guys in Elstree have got to find that one person that goes, I didn't think she sounded like her there, did you? and they've got to find her, mute. But yeah, it'd be wonderful to go back and do it again. It really will. It's the highlight of the year.
Lewis McLeod there. Thanks to him and to Jan Ravens. And fingers crossed, we will see both of them and many of you live, Private Eye at the National Theatre 2022. You heard it here first. That is it for this episode of Page 94 and for the year of Page 94. We hope that you have enjoyed listening. We have certainly enjoyed making it. If you would like to subscribe to the magazine, we strongly encourage that kind of behaviour here. It's available, as I said earlier, at private-eye.co.uk. This episode was produced, as are they all, by Matt Hill of Rethink Audio. Thank you very much for listening, and we will be back again in the new year with another one. Goodbye.